From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleinman, and you're listening to Good Food. We're kicking off the show this week at the Santa Monica Farmers Market. So take it away, Laura.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. According to some chefs, we are in the horse latitudes here at the Farmers Market. We're kind of stuck between seasons, but one thing that's very exciting is there's a new crop of nuts. Jim Russell is probably one of the primary macadamia nut growers here in Southern California. I think most people think of macadamia nuts as coming from Hawaii. Did they at first come only from Hawaii, and how did they wind up in California?
Hawaii did the most work to advertise and build the crop, build it worldwide. They're native to Australia. It's the only commercial food crop native to Australia. And they didn't really even exploit it. The Hawaiians did. If you remember, what, 35 years ago or so, all the United flights into and out of Hawaii, they gave you a little sample pack of macadamia nuts. And that's how the world got introduced to the macadamia. Now, the state legislature there was trying to reforest the islands after several devastating hurricanes. And so they passed a law that said any land planted to macadamias is tax-free for 5 years. So a lot of sugarcane left, and a lot of macadamias came in because of that. The Big Island is where they first started in Hawaii, and that's all lava. So what they did, they punched a hole in the ground, put a half a stick of dynamite in it, and blew a hole, then planted a tree in it.
Tell us about your macadamia farm, how many acres, how many trees, and talk to us about the kind of nuts you grow.
Yeah, I've got a 6-acre farm. It's mostly dedicated to macadamias, but we grow a bunch of other stuff. My wife and I planted these trees 30 years ago. We got 200 macadamia trees. Unfortunately, this year I've got a pretty reduced crop because in June we had a major heat wave and my trees had a great set, but they dumped about half of their nuts, so I'm going to have a shortened stay in the market because my crop is severely limited. But we've got a great following here. We've been in this market for almost 30 years, and I've got some customers still today that were here 30 years ago.
Jim, are there different varieties of macadamia nuts, and what variety do you grow?
There are two botanical varieties that make edible nuts, Integrifolia and the Tetraphylla. I'm growing a horticultural variety, Kate, C-A-T-E, and that's a Tetraphylla. Tetraphylla has about 3% more sugar in it than Integrifolia's, but the world standard for macadamia nut is a nut that's been deep-fried coconut oil and then there's salt glued on it.
Yeah.
And that's why they like the Integrifolia's better than the Tetraphylla. Extra sugar makes it harder to roast them. And the Integrifolia's is a smaller nut and it's a very round nut. So by the time the inside cooked, the outside is not a crispy critter.
Yeah, now you also sell flour, macadamia flour. Do you grind that yourself?
Yeah, I sell both flour and ground. I run them through a chopper, and then I put them in a stainless steel colander and shake it. Whatever falls through is flour, and what stays in is ground.
Did you design some of this equipment yourself?
No, not my specifications. The crackers, a gentleman by the name of Craig Schmad, he bought a piece of property that had macadamias on it, and he took an old washing machine, tore it apart, and made the parts to make a cracker. And so maybe 25 years ago, he cleaned it up and went to a little machine shop in Fallbrook, and they made the first prototype. Well, I bought the first prototype. It had a lot of problems. He didn't have the money to make another one, so I bought the second one, a sight unseen, with our modifications. We still had to make a few modifications after that, but it's a great cracker. I have two of them, so if one breaks, I'm still in business.
When the nuts are falling, how often are you out there looking for them and picking them up?
At least once a week, sometimes twice a week, depending on how the schedule goes for my farmhands and what it takes to get it done. But I never let them lay there more than 2 weeks. There's several little moths, the navel orange worm, the Indian meal moth, the carob moth. They love to parasitize them, and so as soon as they hit the ground, they'll lay an egg where that husk is split open. As soon as that egg hatches, that worm will chew a hole right through that shell into the kernel. Then it's junk. You've got to throw it away. By keeping the weeds out of the grove low, we don't have an economic problem with those moths. Mm-hmm. Maybe 0.1% of my crop I lose because of those things, but that's certainly no reason to start spraying. Once you start spraying, you kill the bad bugs, but you kill the good bugs, and then the bad bugs really come back with a vengeance. So if you start spraying, then you're set to keep doing that. So we don't spray.
That's right. But you don't advertise as organic.
I don't use herbicides or pesticides. I can't advertise as organic because I'm not certified, and I have no intention of being certified. I've got enough bureaucrats in my life. I'm not going to willingly invite more in.
Right. That was Jim Russell. He's the owner of Russell Family Farm down in Fallbrook. We're also now going to talk with Ken Kennedy, also known as Truman Kennedy, Kennedy Family Farm up in Reedley. Let's talk about the walnut crop right now. Tell us about how you decide when to harvest them, what variety they are, and why you picked this particular nut.
Well, particular nuts were on the ranch when we bought it. This year's crop is short. We had enough water, but I didn't overpump because, you know, the neighbors and stuff, and, you know, you're a good keeper of the land, so you just don't overpump. So the tree suffered a little bit, but I think the oil content is a little higher this year. I think the flavor is a little better this year, probably due to that stress. And we've lost a few walnut trees, but what I've done is, as an English walnut tree disappears or dies, usually the black walnut rootstock survives. They're pretty hardy. So I go ahead and cultivate those and bring the black walnut up, so I have black walnuts.
When you talk about planting over to the black walnut, I think a lot of people have never even tried a black walnut. They're so intense.
I think we're the only one with black walnuts in the market. I'll bring some of them still in the shell, and I don't make a lot of money doing that, but the people that recognize them, the older generation, they will stand there and you'll see a grin come on their face. And I go, yep, I used to crack those with a red brick and a hammer. And I learned hold a nut with a pair of pliers because the thumb gets hit quite a bit. But it's a nostalgic nut for most people. But you're right. Mm-hmm. The flavor is almost four times what an English walnut is.
When you harvest the walnuts, now they don't drop by themselves like Jim's macadamia nuts. How do you know when it's time to harvest them?
It's in the fall, and it's usually around the 1st of October, and there's a melody of things that a grower should listen to. You know, you've got all this food hanging on the trees. Well, it's a natural event for a bird to come in and eat your nuts. They won't eat a green nut, and they won't make any noise while they're in the orchard, but lo and behold, when those nuts get ripe, the crows will start cawing, and the blue jays will start chattering, and you better get in there because they'll eat 8 or 10 pounds of nuts a day.
How do birds get through that shell and eat the nut?
You know, this is exciting. You can watch a blue jay come in and snag a walnut, and he'll fly to a telephone pole, sit on the top of it, put that nut down there, and he will actually raise his head and boom with his bill, peck that. And if the nut flies off the pole, he swoops down, picks it, and goes back up. It is bizarre to watch. It's an intelligence that you didn't know was there if you weren't out there seeing it.
Yeah.
Crows are pretty smart.
That was Ken Kennedy. He and his wife, Betty, are up in Reedley. They have walnuts, almonds, lots of fruit, and they're best known for their huge selection of dried fruit as well. For the Nut Report, this is Laura Avery.
Up next, we visit the Red Rooster in Harlem. Stay with us. Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman.
It was important to honor the African-American community, but it was also important to show this level of diversity that Harlem has now evolved on. So when you see Harlem, you see America.
That's Chef Marcus Samuelson. 6 years ago, he opened the Red Rooster in Harlem. Now he's got a new cookbook of the same name. This book is so layered that I found that I had opened it up and been reading through it 4 or 5 times before I even got to a recipe.
Yes. The book took 4 years to do because the photography between Gordon Parks' archive to Bobby Fischer was really important to tell the present, but also be inspired by the past. And I wanted the writing to really give us a sense of place and understanding how complex it is, because it's not an African-American tale. It's an American tale. Beautiful, ugly, delicious, spicy, confusing, but it's our tale. And that takes many narratives to tell a story. So speaking about El Barrio, we needed voices from that articulated. Speaking about style, we needed Dapper Dance and Lana Turner to explain our own beauty. Anytime we talk about sort of an African-American tale, you don't really start at zero, you start at sub-sub-zero. Therefore, you need such articulation in terms of the craftsmanship and writing. Nothing is more powerful than writing.
And also, I think your story brings something even more complex. Your life has been so internally complex. You're Ethiopian by birth, Swedish by adoption, a Black man in America. It's been a geographically and culturally expansive life in which you say in the book that you never felt invisible.
Mm.
So what did moving to Harlem give you that you didn't find anywhere else?
A sense of place and a community and understanding oneself. When I lived in Midtown and worked, it was very important in terms of doing the work of Scandinavian food. But I didn't know my neighbor. And it wasn't my neighbor's fault. It was me not also engaging, being that Manhattanite of not sort of searching for that community. Coming to Harlem, you are nowhere and no one without a community. You see it in the spiritual community through churches, but there's also food there and there's also music there. You see it in the parks where there's also music, food. We wouldn't acknowledge them as restaurants or restaurateurs, but it's all there. So Harlem really shows you that maybe it's because Harlem has always been in recession in one way, but always had a level of pride and buy-in. And I just felt at home.
When you first opened the Rooster, were you immediately embraced or did the community test you?
The community has always, and still is always in front of me and guiding me, sometimes very loud, but they're there and I want their buy-in and I want their passion because it would be much worse if they wouldn't care. In the beginning, we took reservation for the whole restaurant. That was a bad choice because the restaurant was packed, but not from the community. I didn't want to create a restaurant that wasn't for the community. So we had to change. And it was very humbling and scary to say, hey, we're always going to leave a third of the restaurant open for walk-ins when you stood with a lot of bills in front of you. But I knew, the core of me knew, that to try to tell a Harlemite to make a reservation to come to their restaurant would not work.
There's this really interesting conversation that you chronicle in the book where you and a fellow chef are talking about opting out in terms of opting out of big destination restaurants that have nothing to do with the place where you live.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that asking questions and seeing each other sort of being pushed, and I don't know if it was post 9/11 or being in war, but something had actually happened that we knew Manhattan and restaurants, the way we came up in them, something had changed. It doesn't have to be big. It doesn't have to be really bad boy. It could actually be smaller and loving, but also making both the customers and the chef happy. I didn't know how to cook from that place because I've cooked at 3-star Michelin where it was destination, where it was cooking for the 1% of the 1%. At the same time, I was looking for this identity and community. At the same time, my mom was asking me real hard questions. Why do you only trust the banker's taste? You didn't grow up with bankers. Why can't you cook something affordable? And at the same time, in my gut, I knew she was right because I was looking for something else.
Scary to give up that other world.
Very. I can't show it, but I can show you here in studio. Before, my food was very much like this, and now it became much more like this.
Yes, before it was focused on the plate, now it's an embrace.
An embrace, yes. And in one way, it was more embracing my feminine style of my grandmother that was all love cooking. It was all soul food. It was all from the soul, from the heart, and out of poverty. But we ate like millionaires.
It's the best food.
Mm-hmm.
By the time you got to starting to work on Red Rooster, you had gone back to Ethiopia.
Mm.
You had explored Africa. You'd written a cookbook.
Yeah.
So now you're in Harlem. You're ready to open this sort of neighborhood restaurant plus, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a great way of explaining it. I love that. No one has framed it like that.
What are the foods that, or the roads that inform the food there?
That's great. Well, the starting point is the migration. And if you think about the Great Migration, it's giving us so much in terms of culture context. It gave us gospel. It gave us jazz to hip-hop. It gave us everything from Jacob Lawrence to Kyra Walker and everything between. It gave us great storyteller from Maya Angelou to James Baldwin, right? So the culture of African-American journey is really there documented. So 50% of the menu and the food, I knew I wanted to sort of have of that, but also tell a new current tale that talked about farmers market, seasonality, discussing about the immigration that happened in Harlem. So El Barrio, this beautiful Latin community, what's traditional in the Puerto Rican community is today a Mexican-American community. So there's a switch there, but we can talk about that. That's why we have tacos, and that's why we have moles on the menu. There's this rich heritage of Italian-American community. Two of the most iconic Italian-American restaurants in this country come from there, Rao's and Patsy's. People don't know that. And then there's a West African community. So because I'm an immigrant and an African immigrant, I felt I had license to cook from that.
So give me a couple ideas of dishes.
So if you want to start off with a beautiful Berbere-crusted gravlax with injera chips, you can go for the fried yardbird royale, which is a whole fried chicken with beautiful collard greens that has Ethiopian spiced butter. You can have an andouille sausage bread pudding. Cocktail-wise, of course, you can have something like a beautiful Savoy that feels like you're at a rent party. You're listening to probably Ella and a little bit of Dizzy Gillespie, and you might even hear Aretha by the end. All of that by sitting next to a Japanese couple that are taking pictures, next to Jonathan that lives three blocks away from here, arguing about should he get the chicken with the cornbread or should he get the beautiful shoebox ham with some Swedish beautiful Jansom Temptation. Highly delicious, but also highly confusing. This is an American tale. It's also a Donald Trump nightmare.
I love it. Highly delicious and highly American.
Yes.
Highly confusing.
Yes.
No more than right now. I'm glad you threw in the Jansom's Temptation.
Yeah, no, we're throwing it back. My grandma would know better if I wouldn't throw that in during the holidays.
Now, when I first interviewed you, when the restaurant just opened, you talked about how the smell of fear for you was the smell of fried chicken.
Mm-hmm.
Could you just talk a little bit about sort of conquering it?
I come from a place of Ethiopia where if you don't know how to make injera bread, don't even consider yourself a cook. I grew up in a place that if you didn't know what herring should taste like, how can you be from the ocean? So it's beyond the dish. It's part of your DNA. When I thought about opening a restaurant in Harlem, I had to not only have delicious fried chicken, I had to have a point of view. I had to have something to add to the dialogue. Sylvia had done her piece only for 55 years.
Only.
Charles Pan Fried Chicken has been doing it for 40 plus, about 20 blocks away from me. So if I'm going to come in there and do a neighborhood plus restaurant, what's your piece? Where do you stand? So for me, it was about understanding dark meat first, bone in, skin on, double fried, fried on low heat and then on high heat. But what's the spice blend going to be? How big should the cut be? Should it be a 4-pound spurt? Should it be 3.4? Because I didn't want too much water context. So it's highly technical, but also from the heart and of the soul. Because don't come in here with your chefy attitude and ideas if you don't know how to make a staple like fried chicken. And it made me nervous, made me sweat.
You named the basement of your restaurant Ginny's Supper Club. Who is Ginny?
Ginny's is and was everything for me and my partner. Ginny's reflects so many people's that were cooks. Very often they were really in the house as maids, but they did everything. And they never even considered themselves chefs. They were cooking and making do with what was there. Ginny's was the migration. She came from Virginia, came up north, worked in a family, and that family ate Southern food in New York City. That was their comfort food. When Andrew, my partner, and I talked about our basement, Ginny's lived in Harlem, so we're like, it has to be. Can Ginny get in here? I said, of course, this is Ginny's place. We're telling her a story. So one of the happiest days for us was when Andrew brought Ginny's up before she passed. And we celebrated our 80th birthday in Harlem before we opened the restaurant. It was very emotional. And the whole restaurant stopped, and we drank champagne, and we celebrated her. And Ginny is a representative of so many women that came up north to look for better opportunities to provide for their families down south. So we are nothing without Ginny's.
And Ginny's, the space for you, is the basement kind of juke house?
Yeah, I mean, the basement is really, when you think about the word restaurant, it means to restore your community, right? And for African Americans, that meant so many different things. It meant taking a risk. It meant this is where you got the black vote. This is where Rosa Parks could hide out and plan. Well, guess what? We're in similar situations right now. We have to fight for diversity, where it might be called Black Lives Matters, or it might be stop and frisk, or it might be just fighting for the farmers market. Whatever conversation, they should be done in Ginny's. But they should also be highly inspired by music. So this is where Vi Higgins, Gospel Kids, they know they have a home at Ginny's. It's also where the local musician said, hey, we have a place here where people can both eat and hear amazing music. Now, we've been blessed. Pat LaBelle opened it. We have dinner for our president of the United States. John Legend performs in there. We have jam sessions with Alicia Keys. But it's not for the fame. It's really the daily work that we do is mostly anonymous cooks and anonymous customers and anonymous musicians making it happen, jam style, Ginny style, nightly.
Marcus Samuelson's new book is The Red Rooster Cookbook. We've got more good food coming up in 1 minute. Don't go anywhere. I'm Evan Kleinman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. Fidel Castro's ashes were laid to rest in Cuba last Sunday. The bearded revolutionary often had a cigar in his hand, but he had another fixation too, ice cream. Darian Kavanaugh, a writer based in South Carolina, fills us in. His ability to consume mass quantities of ice cream was kind of legendary. So it isn't a huge leap then that the CIA would want to target his ice cream love.
That's absolutely right. He was kind of known for getting a milkshake at the lunch counter of the Havana Libre Hotel pretty much each day. And so the CIA contracted a couple of Cuban mafiosos who kind of held a grudge against Castro anyway because of him shutting down the casinos that they had ties to. So the CIA offered them, I believe it was $150,000, which they were very happy to take for the job. And they subcontracted it to a waiter at the hotel. And the plan was to put a poison pill in his milkshake. I believe it was chocolate that he drank most of the time. They came very close. The server or the waiter made a mistake, though. He stored it in a freezer at the lunch counter. And when he went to retrieve it, it had frozen to the bottom of the freezer. And when he went to grab it, the capsule broke apart and spilled, basically rendering it useless. And he kind of like panicked and just like bailed. And that was kind of the end of that attempt. But by most accounts, that was the closest that the CIA ever came, out of estimates of dozens to several hundred attempts on Castro, that the closest they came was by getting him with a milkshake.
Coppelia's was his state-run ice cream parlor.
Yeah, and it's huge. It's the building itself, I believe, takes up a full city block. But then there's also like another block of like green spaces, like kind of dedicated to it around there. They're just like kind of a park around it. It's a big two-story building. It has, I think, 5 separate parlors in it. It used to be open from pretty early in the morning to like almost 2 a.m.
I understand that the most popular order is called ensalada, which is a 5-scoop sampler plate.
Yeah, yeah. You get like one of each of the like main flavors that they have that day.
I would definitely order that. So Cubans still associate Fidel with ice cream and with Coppelia's.
I think they would have to some extent. I mean, and it's in one of the busiest parts of Havana, so people see it all the time. He was very proud of it. There's a great photo of him and George McGovern eating ice cream cones together, like surrounded by a pool of reporters. Patrick Leahy, senator from Vermont, when he went and visited, again, they went to Coppelia, and it created this ongoing friendship with them where Leahy would like send down cases of Ben and Jerry's to Castro and to compare the two ice creams. And then from there, they started exchanging family photos.
Can we talk for a minute about just his fascination with cows and trying to create different breeds of cattle?
Yeah, absolutely. After the embargo, even with the assistance from the Soviet Union up until the 90s, you know, their economy was struggling. And he really wanted to be able to provide like some basic sustenance and some sense of security and develop an industry that could kind of sustain the country. He focused on wanting to create better beef cows and better milk cows. Milk was a big thing. He wanted everyone to be able to have a glass of milk with dinner. And it was kind of this like symbol of like a security and prosperity. And it was kind of like his version of a chicken in every pot to some extent. Is, you know, if everyone could have a glass of milk each night, then things were still somewhat okay. But Cuba did not have good milk cows. So he wanted to bring in Holsteins. So he bought, I think initially, several thousand from Canada. But Holsteins, of course, just are not adapted to the climate in Cuba at all. And during the hot months, they would either die off or just lose massive amounts of weight and not be able to produce milk. They would just become really unhealthy. I think within a few weeks of importing the first few thousand cows from Canada, I think a third of them died, the Holsteins. So the next phase of it was to just build these huge indoor barns, these climate-controlled facilities that were just like massive, and be like, oh, we'll just put them in there with air conditioning. But of course, that didn't really work either. The cows didn't adapt. The numbers of cows that continued to decline, milk production from them was still subpar. And so then he kind of gave up on the Holsteins finally and decided that he was going to create his own new super cow, what he eventually dubbed Tropical Holsteins. That was an utter failure as well, except for one instance. Out of all of their efforts, they bred this one cow, Ubra Blanca, that did produce amazing amounts of milk. And so Castro just made this huge thing about it. Like, he'd do TV interviews, you know, at her side. Grandma, the, you know, the Communist Daily, would run daily updates on Ubra Blanca. When she died, she was on the front page again, and there's a huge eulogy in there for her. And then they built a marble statue in her honor that still stands in her hometown. Castro had a bunch of her eggs frozen and several samples of her tissue, and periodically will have people at his genetics labs try to clone her, or at least begin development of cloning. They got really excited when Dolly the sheep was cloned and thought they would be able to make some breakthrough then, but they have not. But those cells and tissues are still on storage, and I don't know if Raul's going to try to pick that project up down the road or not.
Darren Kavanaugh is a writer based in South Carolina. Find the link to his article, Fidel Castro Had a Bizarre Obsession with Milk, on our website. Now let's turn to a man who's actually eaten scoops with Fidel. That would be television and film director Rodrigo Garcia. Because your dad was the remarkable writer Gabriel Garcia Marquez, you had to have spent your childhood amongst super heavy hitters, culturally speaking. And one of them was Fidel Castro, as I understand.
Yeah, my father first visited Cuba in 1959, right after the revolution there triumphed. And he was a journalist, and he was writing for, I think, a newspaper in Venezuela or in Colombia. So he didn't meet Fidel until 1975, when he returned with the intention of writing a series of articles about Cuba. And at that time, he met with Fidel, and they became personal friends for a long time.
So do you remember how old you were and what the circumstances were the first time you shared food with him?
You know, I remember meeting him a couple times. The first time I met him, I must have been 15 or 16. You know, the first few times we saw him, we didn't break bread with him because we were always staying in hotel rooms. Fidel always visited you. It was one of the ways that his security ran things. They would always say he was en movimiento, on the move. You never knew where he slept. So the first few times it was limited. After a couple of years, as their friendship progressed and they met more and more, I think for security reasons, his detail decided that it was best to have my father stay at a guest house. So he was assigned eventually to guest house number 6, which was, you know, a house in a fine neighborhood in Havana where most of the owners had left because there was, you know, people with money who were exiled after the revolution. The houses were expropriated, and they were fancy homes, so they were used for diplomats, for special guests, etc. So at these houses, Fidel would visit, and yes, there, you know, that's where there would be food. So there was always, you know, ice cream in the refrigerator, many huge vats of the most sugar-high, fat-high egg-high things that you can imagine. You know, there were the Cubans, Fidel in particular, were super proud of the Copelia ice cream. But, I mean, I have to imagine, I didn't know this then, but I have to imagine that, you know, that is ice cream that now would be marketed in this country as, you know, straight out of a cow, straight out of a chicken. You know, nothing there had anything that you couldn't pronounce. And of course, some of the best and sweetest sugar in the world.
Did you ever go to Copelia?
I went to Copelia once, though the lines were famously long. You know, there was a one big Copelia store in Havana, and it was super popular with everyone. So, you know, unless I suppose if you went at some odd hours, but I remember, you know, I must have driven by there many times over a span of maybe 10 years, and there was always a line. You know, I'm sure Cuban sympathizers would say it was a line because it was very popular. And Cuban antagonists would say, oh, it was a line because there was only one store and communism is a failure and blah, blah, blah.
Do you remember if he had a special flavor?
You know, I remember him eating like, you know, vanilla, chocolate. I think in some ways flavors that, I mean, I think so. When I go to a new ice cream store, I have to try some of the classics before I get distracted by the fancy flavors. And, you know, I think there was a flavor called mantecado, which I think is vanilla, but with yolks, which is a very rich vanilla.
French vanilla, that's called.
That was French vanilla, okay. It was like eating a steak. It was so rich and so sweet. And I think I have the feeling he was a sort of vanilla and chocolate guy.
He was apparently a famed foodie, which isn't surprising. What were some of his favorite eats?
You know, he spoke a lot about food and loved to interrogate people about foods from their countries. And he was a big fan of cod, which is not a fish that you can fish in the Caribbean. So because of, you know, friends and connections and diplomats or, you know, Cubans traveling, you know, he would sometimes receive a little import of a couple packs of, you know, salted cod. You know, and he was always experimenting with recipes and, you know, the ongoing debate about how much water and how many days do you need to desalt the cod to the right level. My mom had a delicious cod recipe, which was cod with leeks and potatoes. He flipped over that recipe and learned it and perfected it himself, I think.
So to give a bit of era context to this idea of foodie Fidel, are we talking pre or post Soviet collapse?
No, pre Soviet collapse. I mean, the time that I visited there were the late 70s and 80s. You know, obviously the country was under some relative economic pressures and it was subject to the U.S. blockade. So it was very, you know, a lot of things were very difficult. But starting from the late 70s and into the 80s, you know, more and more countries, including all the Latin American countries, established diplomatic relations with Cuba. So, yeah, I mean, they were always under pressure, but, you know, like, for example, their health system was famous, their educational system was famous. So, you know, that was probably a period where things were a little better, where there were more visitors than ever before, where he might have received, you know, gifts and foods. And obviously, being the head of state, you know, I'm sure he had, you know, unparalleled, you know, access to things and privileges. But I think after the fall of the Berlin Wall, you know, they fell under such what they called the special period, very elegantly, but which really just, you know, they were broke. You know, I didn't visit after that, but, you know, I can't imagine there were fancy foods.
Was it intimidating for a kid of your age to sit at the table with him?
Well, I mean, increasingly so as I got older, because, you know, when you're 15, 16, you don't give history the weight, you know, that it deserves. I think later in my 20s, you know, as I visited more and learned more and studied more and certainly started to form, you know, my own opinions about the Cuban Revolution, which were mixed. You know, the Cuban Revolution, of course, was a symbol of incredible idealism and of you know, standing up against imperialism the way the Vietnamese had. But, you know, after decades of the same system, you know, things invariably got more complicated. So my feelings became more mixed. But the physical presence of Fidel in the room, I haven't been there in 30 years, but I was 28 or 29 when I saw him last, so I was already an adult. You know, when Fidel was in the room, Fidel was in the room. You know, I work in the film business, and I've yet to meet a movie star that walks into the room and it feels like Fidel. And I'm not saying that necessarily as praise. It's just the weight of history. You know, he was a man who actually led a left-wing revolution in Latin America, which many countries were fighting to do. He defeated a dictatorship backed by the U.S. government and U.S. business. You know, he was part of the Cuban Missile Crisis. He was Kennedy's foe. He survived 600 CIA murder attempts. He was the friend of Che Guevara. So whatever you thought of him, you know, history was in the room. And then physically, it was imposing. He was always in his green fatigues, and he had the beard and the cigar.
Did he cook?
He did cook himself. I mean, he didn't cook in the guest house when he came to visit us, but he did cook in his own world. And, you know, what that world was, I never knew. I mean, I think at some point there was an official apartment that was his residence. But again, he was always on the move. You know, exactly where Fidel slept was a mystery. I think my parents might have gone no more than twice in a friendship of decades to what might have been the Fidel apartment where he, if he didn't cook, he certainly approved the menu, supervised it, you know, put the spoon in the pot and tried the level of salt. I mean, it was very, the whole food thing. And also he was very big on foods that could be potentially healthy. He was always looking for a special type of honeybee that produced a honey that might be good for such and such a thing. Or I remember once he had heard that the Chinese do shark fin soup, and there's a lot of sharks in the area. So he and his team, I don't know if they were cooks or scientists, explored the shark fin to death and cooked and recooked and did soups and things. And he found that its nutritional value was really quite low.
It's so interesting, though, to be able to become obsessed with something and have the power and means to exploit it fully intellectually.
Yeah, because, you know, he would talk about this lab where he had things tested, and I don't know if this was a lab that he'd put together or just someone from the National Institution of Nutrition or whatever it was. But, yes, I mean, he would find things like moringa. Do you know what moringa is? Moringa is a tree.
Now it's like a superfood.
Now it's like a superfood. I have to hand it to him that already 10 years ago, I wasn't there, but my mom told me that he became obsessed with it and was researching it. And, you know, I think he had the personal passion for it, but he was also looking for, you know, something that the Cubans could have that others didn't have that was just good for your health. I mean, there was always with food a combination of him being a foodie, but also him wanting to discover these superfoods that would make the Cubans super Cubans. You know, moringa was one of them. Another one is something called propolis.
The royal jelly.
The royal jelly. It's a kind of wax that the bees produce to shore up their beehives. That dated back to the 80s. I remember he was a big fan of royal jelly and you know, all the miracles that it could do.
Earlier in our conversation, you mentioned that he interrogated people about food. What were some of the questions? Were they equally economic and cultural as well as about flavor?
I think about everything. I mean, I think, you know, he was a very curious guy. And I think one of the things that surprised most people who visited him, especially if you were not a head of state, if you were just a civilian, you know, he would interrogate people about their lives. Where did you live? How did you grow up? What did your parents do? What did you eat as a kid? What was that like? Yesterday, I remembered once that there was a minister of culture or something, someone who had traveled to Spain and on the way back realized on the plane that Fidel had probably never eaten off of a little food tray from an airline. He brought with him a couple of food trays from the airline. And we were there when Fidel got them and unwrapped them and ate them with great curiosity and interest. I think he judged the food to be like we would judge it. It was certainly interesting to see a man who, you know, lives in a kind of vacuum eating a tray of food from Iberia Airlines.
Are there any other stories or anything else you can think of to share?
He was the first person I heard, you know, when I was in my early 20s, talk about how many calories he was eating and how he couldn't eat more than 2,500 calories a day or he would gain weight, which I now realize for a person his size who exercised as much as he exercised.
Tiny amount of food.
It's not that much food, so maybe he was already clued into the benefits of calorie restriction.
To become immortal.
Yeah, exactly. To live as long as possible. And, you know, he did give up his famous cigars, I'm sure for himself, but, you know, he framed it as, you know, an example to everyone in the country. I don't think anyone else gave them up.
That's television and film director Rodrigo Garcia taking us back to the time he ate ice cream with Fidel.
7-Eleven. Oh, boy. What you want when you want it. Like a zesty, spicy 7-Eleven burrito.
Oh, boy.
Or a 7-Eleven ham and cheese.
Oh, boy.
A cold drink and a 7-Eleven chili dog.
Oh, boy.
We're playing this vintage 7-Eleven video clip for you to set the scene for our next segment, which is all about food at convenience stores. But we're not talking about an American roadside stop. 7-Eleven. We're traveling to Japan. Our guide is Good Food Supervising Producer Abby Fentress Swanson. Recently, she took a trip to Tokyo, and of course, she went on a food crawl to convenience stores all over the city. You know, it's so funny. I remember when I was planning my trip to Tokyo, and the first thing all my friends who had been before said to me was, you have to go to the convenience stores. Did that happen to you?
Yeah, the same thing happened to me. And I was so surprised because I had never even heard of, really, Japan having amazing convenience store food. You know, I think about our 7-Elevens and our Quick Marts, which, you know, I do love some of them. And they're great for roadside stops in a pinch when you need something. But not gourmet, like really what I found in Japan.
Or even just simple edible.
Exactly. Would you touch the hot dogs or the chips with the melted cheese?
No, I'm never going there. Tell me which one of the chains, where did you go?
We tried, and I say we, I was with two of my traveling companions. We went to some of the biggest chains, and those are Lawson, 7-Eleven, and Family Mart.
Is any of the food that you see in these places prepped on site in the individual stores, or are they all done off site in giant commissaries?
At the Lawson that we went to and we interviewed a representative there, he told us that 3,000 locations in Japan alone have kitchens right on site. So it is true that many that you go into, you know, you'll see them frying chicken, you know, making sandwiches in the back and making, of course, some of my favorite onigiri, the rice balls with delicious things inside.
Yeah, that was definitely my move, too. So good.
Yeah, and you could get one for the equivalent of a buck. You know, there are also a dozen different kinds. You know, onigiri stuffed with grilled salmon, salmon roe, spicy tuna, mayonnaise, and then just vegetables. Yeah, it was great.
Really, really good. Give us some of the highlights of the food. Explain the sort of panoply, the range that's available.
The wide range. Yeah, so you walk into one of these locations and, you know, there's not just one cooler or one little circular island where you might find coffee or something. No, there are like five or six coolers. One of them was completely devoted to these rice balls we're talking about, onigiri, triangular-shaped, nori-wrapped balls of rice with things stuffed inside. So there's one cooler devoted completely to them, onigiri, but another cooler is devoted completely to fresh-cut sandwiches.
And we should talk about the sandwiches because—
yeah.
The bread is incredible.
It's incredible. It's this white bread. It's kind of hard to, I don't know how they make it. Sometimes the crust is cut off and sometimes it's on, but it just kind of melts in your mouth.
They're like the best, like you wish your mother made you these kind of sandwiches when you were a kid.
Sorry, Mom. Yes. Yes, I do. My favorite sandwich, I know you take issue with this, is the carb on carb soba sandwich.
It's the photograph of it. It's not very pretty.
Well, it's soba noodles inside a roll, but it was delicious. And I understand from some of the people I interviewed before I went and after I went that the carb-on-carb sandwich in Japan is quite popular. And also another great sandwich was one with one-half pork tonkatsu and one-half egg salad.
Wow. And pork tonkatsu is the fried pork cutlet that, man, they do so well
so
there.
Well.
Beverages are also like—
I know. Lawson, when we did go, I'm sorry I'm getting back to Lawson again, but since we did interview a representative from that company, he really gave us the complete 411. And they have Italian coffee machines in their stores. So you can get, you know, a macchiato made to order. You can get a frothy matcha green latte, which I had, which was delicious. So we're not talking about, you know, a pot of coffee that was brewed 12 hours ago that's just been sitting there. These are fresh made to order coffees. It's great. There's also another cooler devoted to smoothies. So you can get smoothies for breakfast if you want. And we did see two ladies come get smoothies, stand outside the store, drink them in like 5 minutes, and then throw them away in the garbage can and then go to work. That was pretty good and fresh and delicious and all, again, very affordable.
So is there a reason why this kind of like super edible, almost homey convenience store food has grown so much in the last decade?
Yeah, I asked our representative from Lawson about that, too. His name is Ming Lee. And he said it's because women are working more, so they're spending less time at home cooking. I think also the business has just grown. I mean, there are 50,000 convenience stores in Japan. So, it makes sense if you have a neighborhood market that you would just go there when there's so much available instead of going to a supermarket farther away.
One of my favorite little nuggets that you uncovered is that they have food specially made for the elderly.
Yeah, I loved that. And I had actually seen an NPR story about that earlier this year. On the package of all kinds of foods that you can get and heat up mostly, there's a chewability scale from 1 to 5. So it's great. You know, if you have dentures, you're getting older, you know, you can say, I need a 3. I need a 4. I just think that's a great thing to offer for senior citizens, especially in a place like Japan where there are more older people.
I know that for a while there was a chain here in L.A. that was really trying to make a go of it. Famima. Are they related to any of the stores you went to?
Yes. That was Family Mart's American attempt at starting convenience stores of the Japanese ilk here, but they didn't last here. And I'm not sure what the reason was because Family Mart didn't get back to me on that. I just think maybe in places like Tokyo, it's a densely populated city, small kitchens, small fridges, so more people are eating out, whereas here it just didn't work so well.
It's an option. And, you know, I would think to myself, boy, I really wish I had an onigiri. This was before there were stores where you could get them, separate stores. And then I'd think, well, but then I have to drive across town. You know, it's not worth it. Then it's no longer convenient.
Yeah, and LA's a big city, so.
We would need 50,000 of them just here in LA.
Which I would vote for. If you want to give another shot, Family Mart, I'm in.
We published a blog post here at Good Food, which also has a video. And there's been a ton of response to it online. What have people mostly said?
Yeah, I was apparently the last person to ever eat at convenience stores in Japan because everyone else has already been there. We got some great feedback. Let's see. Someone wrote, I lived off of Family Mart's inari rolls and yogurt drinks the past 2 weeks in Japan. All my husband ate most days working in a small town in Japan came from the 7-Eleven. Got another good one. Americans don't appreciate the carb-on-carb magic. Japanese do. In addition to this fine example of a yakisoba sandwich, a classic, the potato salad sandwich.
Well, no, that I would go for that.
That one you would go for.
I would go for that.
And we can't live without Family Mart's juicy butter French toast. I must have eaten it 6 times while we were there. And then there are many more people talking about sushi, the Haagen-Dazs crispy sandwich, green tea flavor. A lot of people like the onigiri. So
I also think there's something wonderful about a type of store that's perfect for tourists who don't speak the language because you walk in, you see everything. So all you have to do is browse and grab. And the price is so low that you're like, hey, I'm going to spend $20 and just see what works.
Yes. And in fact, that is exactly what I did on the last day is I spent $25. And if you do go to our website, to our blog, you'll see all of the food I was able to get for, I think it was $24, quite a lot. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner covered for a few days. And then I threw in an extra $10 and got some very fancy Japanese whiskey to go.
It's time for a trip to Tokyo. Watch a video of our supervising producer, Abby Fentress-Swanson, shopping for her favorite convenience store eats on our website. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood. Ha, I'm at the Pizza Hut. What? I'm at the Taco Bell. What? I'm at the combination Pizza Hut and Taco Bell. Up next, we hear where our favorite food critic is dining this week. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleinman.
We are going to a part of downtown L.A. that I sometimes think of as the Joseph Centeno District.
That's L.A. Times food critic Jonathan Gold.
His latest is called PYT, which he sort of disingenuously says stands for Pretty Young Turnip, but we can assume what we wish.
And this is his ode to the vegetable, right?
It is. It's a mostly vegetarian restaurant that he carved out of half of Ledlow.
So PYT, Pretty Young Things, the plates look like they're gorgeous.
They are. They're really well composed. I've always been a huge fan of the crudité plate that he does next door at Ledlow, and they do one here it really does look like something that exists to be painted rather than eaten.
How many times should you go, by the way?
Five, maybe six.
Were there craveable dishes for you?
I think the rock star dish there is, he calls it a salt baked turnip. It's a whole turnip. It's wrapped in hoja santa, which is the Mexican herb. It's big, it's floppy. It has a anise flavor to it. He wraps it in the herb, then he puts it into a salt crust. He comes, breaks it open, takes out the vegetable, and then, puts it on a plate with a herb sauce that has little bits of shiso, the Japanese herb, in it.
Wow.
I think the idea is that you have something that's a vegetable, but it's being served with the ceremony of a roast.
And is it transformed in the way that it's cooked? I would imagine it's very long cooked.
It's cooked for a while. Every bite of it seems to be different. So the outside may be like a little bit tough. It gets a little more tender as it gets towards the center. And when you get to the very center, it concentrates and it becomes sweet and it somehow becomes like more turnip than a turnip.
Is this a purely vegetarian restaurant?
It's pretty purely vegetarian. The only meat on the menu appears like very much at the bottom where you can get a pork chop or a ribeye or some uni. I think the idea is to have a vegetarian menu with a token meat item at the bottom in the way that vegetarians always complain that the token vegetarian thing is a dull plate of steamed vegetables.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. Okay, give us some of the highlights.
He does a bowl of Anson Mill grits that he tops with some amaranth leaves and shavings of pecorino sardo, a pungent pecorino, and some pickled greens and some seeds. When it was in season, there was a dish of melon served with persimmons and sort of crunchy crumbs over it, a bit of avocado and not really much of a dressing, a little bit of like tartness and creaminess from some buttermilk. It's vegetarian, but it's not like especially vegan. And one of the things he's doing there that I think both of us have to applaud is he works very closely with Lala Farm, which is a farm actually on the campus of the LA Leadership Academy in the East LA neighborhood of Lincoln Heights. They have a chef salad every day that has, between 8 and 12 vegetables grown on that farm. So you have like kids involved in growing stuff, and I imagine that they're excited to see the vegetables they grow treated so lovingly and cooked so well.
Are these vegetable items things that one would classify in one's mind as like salads or, quote, side veg? How do you go about ordering?
They're not side veg. There's a section of the menu that's mostly raw things, right? So you'll have the crudités, you'll have a beet carpaccio. Oh, and another thing I should probably mention is there's something at the beginning of the menu that says chapati bread. You'd probably pass right by it. But the chapatis, while they're very little like the chapatis you would find in like a Punjab restaurant, are really good. I mean, they're soft, they're buttery, they're served with little things of butter flavored with koji, the sake mold in corn or coconut or a kind of hummus that he makes with heirloom beans.
Oh, that sounds good.
For another couple bucks, you can get all three, and you probably should. I also really like what he's doing with pasta. The one that's probably the best is hand-torn pasta, which I guess is like malfatti. It's not that kind of chunky, clunky handmade pasta that a lot of chefs in town are doing now. It's the soft, supple kind that's probably dressed pretty simply with, brown butter and some herbs. And he does a version of khachapuri, which might be the last thing you would expect here.
The Georgian cheese bread.
The Georgian cheese bread, which I suppose is their equivalent of a pizza, which comes with burrata and something they do with carrot ferns. That's carrot tops, right?
Yep.
And you got to use the carrot tops. You have to use every part of the vegetable now. And, the inevitable egg. You knew the egg was coming, didn't you?
Of course.
And the token meat at the end, you might as well have the token meat, because if you're eating a pork chop, it's going to be a really good pork chop.
Was there anything for you that didn't work so well?
Yeah, they do a version of piri piri rice, the sort of African Portuguese dish. That's sort of mushy, and the herb mix didn't work so well. I had it a couple times, and that might be the one to not get.
Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times, is talking about PYT in downtown LA. Text the words good food to 69866, and you'll get Jonathan's weekly restaurant recommendations. Where did you come from, baby? And ooh, won't you take me back? That is it for this week's show. If you missed any part of it, you can listen to the show at kcrw.com or on KCRW's mobile app. As always, so many thanks to the Good Food team. They are
Abby Fentress Swanson,
Laurel Garcia,
Joseph Stone.
Hey, Abby, here's mine, Camellia Say,
Joel Stein,
and Ronnie Mickelson.
And of course, I'm Evan Kleinman. I'll be back next week with more good food.